Blog Talk Radio.
I could not be silent in the face of such cruel manipulation of the poor. It moves to an even deeper level of awareness. For it grows out of my experience in the ghettos of the North over the last 3 years, especially the last 3 summers. As I have walked among the desperate, rejected, and angry young men, I have told them that Molotov cocktails and rifles would not solve their problems. I have tried to offer them my deepest compassion while maintaining my conviction that social change comes most meaningfully through nonviolent action. But they ask, and rightly so, what about Vietnam? They ask if our own nation wasn't using massive doses of violence to solve its problems, to bring about the changes it wanted. Their questions hit home, and I knew that I could never again raise my voice against the violence of the oppressed in the ghettos without having first spoken clearly to the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today, my own government. For the sake of those boys, for the sake of this government, for the sake of the hundreds of thousands trembling under our violence, I cannot be silent. For those who ask the question, aren't you a civil rights leader? And thereby mean to exclude me from the movement for peace, I have this further answer. In 1957, when a group of us formed the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, we chose as our motto to save the soul of America. We were convinced that we could not limit our vision to certain rights for black people, but instead affirmed the conviction that America would never be free or saved from itself until the descendants of its slaves were loose completely from the shackles they still wear.
Good evening, good evening. Welcome to another episode of Your World News. I'm your host, Solomon Kamajan. Thank you for joining us. This is a community-based radio station, as we always like to say, because it seems that each week we'll continue to have a rotating schedule of special guests, special co-hosts, and this week is no exception. So I'd like to thank you all for joining in on this beautiful Thursday, May 14th, 2009. We've got a power-packed show for you for the next an hour and 27 or 26 odd minutes. It's going to be completely engaging, and as they say, time flies when you're having fun and gaining information and gaining power through information that is seldom shed by the mainstream media. And when it is shed by the mainstream media, it's often shed in a very narrowly framed context. So it's going to be fun today. And joining me today, I'm going to introduce in a couple minutes, is a really special guest and a good friend of mine by the name of John Judge. John is a researcher. He's an activist. He's a public speaker. He's a social activist. He's been doing amazing work in the community for the last 2-3 decades at least, and I'm going to have John introduce himself in a few moments, and by the end of the show, a couple different times throughout the show, I'm going to have John give his information to you, the listener, because as he starts to speak and as he starts to put things in his proper context in terms as it relates to his research in a number of areas, you're probably going to be intrigued the same way I was when I first heard him. When I first heard this man, I knew that he was somebody I wanted to try to bring in for my organization to be a public speaker, and we brought him in, and he served as a public speaker and talked about, it was a speech called The Dark Side of the Pentagon, and talked about how the relation between the military-industrial complex and how it adversely affects people of color. And so we brought him in, and it was a fantastic, well-received public lecture that a lot of people that attended continue to maintain contact with John over the years. And so he's going to talk about some of his expertise, his experiences, And I'm going to keep him on throughout the show. He's going to be kind of like my co-host today. He's my co-pilot. And we're here. We're flying the plane of information, and you guys are all strapped in. And our destination is higher consciousness. So as we traverse through this journey, we're going to be talking about everything from the work he did when he worked for Cynthia McKinney, who, if you don't know who Cynthia McKinney is, she by far, you know, was one of the most progressive Congress people in the last few decades that we had. She served about 12 years in the House as a congresswoman from the state of Georgia, and you know, she had the courage to be that inconvenient hero for all of us. Pressed people like Donald Rumsfeld on issues that, you know, quite frankly, most of her colleagues in the Democratic Party were not stepping up to the plate. And so she actually just recently ran for president under the Green Party ticket with Rosa Clemente. And so we'll talk about all those things. And we'll talk about everything from the swine flu to the military-industrial complex to some things related with some of the policies that President Obama and his administration are unfortunately passing and putting into place, which seems eerily like much of the same. I mean, these military strikes, these airstrikes that we see in Afghanistan that are killing a vast majority of innocent civilians, seems eerily like the occupation and the early stages of the occupation in Iraq. So, John, are you with us right now?
Yes, I am. So.
Okay, John. Before I get to some of the headlines, can you introduce yourself to the listeners? Who you are? Some of the research that you've done throughout the years, just so they can kind of get a feel and tenor for the person that's going to be talking to them throughout the evening.
Well, I've been an anti-militarist, anti-war activist, anti-racism activist since the 1960s. I worked in opposition to the war in Vietnam. I counseled people facing the draft and people in the military and veterans. I organized veterans when they came back and organized active duty people through Vietnam Veterans Against the War, Winter Soldier Organization, National GI Project. And then I also started bringing veterans into high schools about 1968 to counter the military recruiters and their lies, and I continue to do that in the D.C. schools and have since 1985 with an organization called Choices we can talk about later. I grew up around the Pentagon, the CIA, the NSA. Those were my neighbors. My parents were civilian employees of the Pentagon, and I always knew there were several governments operating. I was very critical of the military from very early on, and I did a lot of research when I was young, studied in the Pentagon Library when my mother would leave me off there, and came out against the war in 1964, and then have been doing that kind of organizing and training people, the history of the intelligence agencies, the rise of fascism and Nazism, and the post-war transfer of fascism and Nazis here to the United States that formed the Cold War policies. I looked into the assassination of John F. Kennedy, and that led me into Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King, Malcolm X's assassination. I had a national organization, Coalition on Political Assassinations, that does regular conferences and unearths the best new hard evidence in these assassinations. I've been working more recently on a museum of hidden history in Washington, D.C. that would tell the history that the other museums and the system don't tell us, the history that they try to hide from us and
right.
Make that public for young people. I've done a lot of work on 9/11, not connected with 9/11 Truth, but a 9/11 research project and formerly 9/11 Citizens Watch that helped get an investigation. And those files are starting to be released now so that their investigative files and interviews can actually be compared to their report. I'm sure they're going to undermine the report once they're out. And I think, you know, working to get files loose, I've been doing some work on getting a bill passed, and it's moving now in Congress toward hearings on the releasing the files on the life and death of Dr. King. You know, his everything that he did and what he stood for, which is much beyond the civil rights leader that they freed him as in 1963. So,
yeah.
I think that we need to look at real history if we're going to get anywhere. And I think that we're also in a tremendous crisis now, a crisis for the planet, a crisis for the economy, a crisis for all the humans living on the planet as well as other species. And we really have to take this seriously and start to sit down and figure out how ordinary people are going to change things from the bottom up to get out of this, because nothing is changing from the top down. And,
you're right.
So I'm a political activist and continue to try to look for real solutions to problems, but I do that by starting first with researching things and finding out what the truth is of the situation that we're in and analyzing that, and that has led me into several movements and political positions. And sometimes I'm kind of out there ahead of people and chopping through the jungle, and I turn around, nobody's behind me, but I still think I'm going the right direction. So.
But yeah, you're right, and you bring up a good point, and that's why I think it was so apropos that we led with, Dr. King, one of his, least, popular, speeches, and that was, Beyond Vietnam, Breaking the Silence, and you're right, Dr. King is frozen in 1963 as if, there was nothing between 1963 and 1968 when he was killed.
Yes.
And that little soundbite they always play, from 1963, they most of the time play that out of context. But, yeah. He spoke truth to power. I mean, he spoke about the ills of the military-industrial complex. He spoke about excessive materialism. Of course, he spoke about racism, and he spoke out against the hypocrisies about this about the Vietnam War. And that was probably the speech that was the final nail in the coffin that led to his assassination. And I think that's you're carrying that same kind of vein that when you speak about as you trudge through the woods, you feel sometimes you don't have anybody with you, and that's unfortunate, because I think that the mentality has been shaped with most of America by this corporate backed mainstream media. And it's put folks into this kind of like zombification, and so those of you guys that are listening, kind of like I said, strap yourselves in, because you're going to hear some things that may initially maybe offend you. If you're a supporter of Barack Obama, and it's not that we're certainly not certainly not Republicans, certainly not like staunch Democrats, but we do believe in speaking truth to power. And so what the mainstream media won't tell you, we're going to try to place in its proper context. And unfortunately, there are some things, and I say unfortunately, not because I'm concerned with his own self-aggrandizement in terms of his career, but I say unfortunately because there are a lot of lives that are at stake with policies that are shaped through an administration, through the cabinet members and so forth, and ultimately through the complicity of the people who kind of go lock and step with a cult of personality, which is, I think, what we see with Barack Obama. We see the fact that if this was John McCain doing these military airstrikes in Afghanistan, where innocent civilians were being killed, in scores, I think that there's a whole lot of people that voted for Obama would be up in arms, because it's exactly the same thing that was going on in Iraq. John, what have you been researching the last week that you can tell our listeners about what's going on in Afghanistan and why it's so eerily similar to the initial phases of the Bush aggression and occupation in 2003 and beyond in Iraq?
Well, all of the response over there comes from our tremendous arrogance that we have the right to go into other countries and determine who will be in charge of those countries. Of course, it's not so much that we care who's in charge or what it looks like, as long as we're assured that we're stabilizing the region for our investments there and our control of resources there and oil and other resources and wealth that we want to either get our own hands on or keep certain other countries like Japan and Germany from having. So much of what drives our policy in that whole region is the Caspian Basin, one of the largest oil deposits on Earth, being just north of a lot of the stands where we're creating permanent military bases. And, you know, they started talking about getting out of Iraq after they finished building a massive embassy and finishing the permanent military bases there. And I don't think they have any intention to remove those bases. You know, they talk about reducing the number of troops, but not to zero. Mm-hmm. And now the war is moving out in ways that are violating the same articles of impeachment, because I did help to research close to 100 legal international law, domestic law, and constitutional violation grounds for impeachment against Bush and Cheney and the administration that just went out of power. Sadly, quite a few of those same charges that could be laid at Bush's feet, you know, have been violated yet again by the current president, including, you know, preemptive strikes and illegal warfare, violation of sovereignty of Pakistan by sending the Predators in and the missiles in, similarly going into Afghanistan now. And the kind of warfare that we're waging there, which is the nature of modern warfare, is that it's genocidal. It kills civilians at a ratio, now they're saying, of 50-1. And there's charges that we're using white phosphorus or napalm there, as we did in Iraq. And those are violations of international standards for what weapons are able to be used. And so all of this violates the oath of office that Obama took to uphold the Constitution, to carry out the laws faithfully, and that includes honoring international treaties which have the weight of law and not violating war crimes. And many of the excesses of the Bush administration, the wiretapping has not been stopped. It's been supported more recently. Official Secrets Act has been evoked by the Bush or by the Obama team, you know, in order to keep people from getting certain secrets out. Things that he said he would do when he was a senator and worked on, and he's now reversing on, like these photos of the abuse at Abu Ghraib. He doesn't want them released. He also has said that he wants to maintain the military commissions, which Cynthia McKinney, when I was there, we fought the passage of that bill and tried to get that changed. There's no reason to have military commissions years after the event. They're just ad hoc things you create when you're in a battlefield and you can't do anything else.
Right.
You don't do a combat status review 3 years after the event when there's no witnesses and try to figure out the combat status of someone. This is just ridiculous. I mean, and it's putting the decisions in the hands of the military, you know, to determine the fate of many people who were just turned over for a bounty originally and have been languishing in these horrible prisons, some of them tortured or renditioned. And now Obama this week is also saying that he's still considering keeping people in indefinite detention.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because even the people who got a trial and got acquitted on the trial are not released because they're in these suspect categories of enemy combatants. So you can win your acquittal and still be in prison, and he's continuing those practices. So many things that he said he would change, and some things he didn't, but people assumed he would change, are not being changed at this point. But the other thing that happened this week is the replacement of the head officer for Afghanistan operations,
right.
McKiernan, replaced by McChrystal. And McChrystal is a special forces guy that has a history in Iraq of countering the insurgents and also of being part of the team that captured Saddam Hussein, based on information they were given by the Kurds, you know, who had been holding him for quite some time. But he's taking credit for that, and he's being seen as this new superstar. They're calling him, it's rising up. But he's the officer who was specifically responsible for lying to the family of Pat Tillman. You know, a guy that enlisted in the war and believed it at first, but began to read about it. He was said to have been reading Chomsky, and his parents said he was starting to write to them and speaking against the war. And then he's killed in what clearly to me from the forensics is a friendly fire situation, if not a fragging. They're calling it friendly fire. First they lied about that, you know, said it was accidental. He was shot at such close quarters in the head several times that it can't be other than an intentional murder. And, you know, either other brass might have shot him because he was changing his opinions, or enlisted people for some reason were shooting him. But this was clearly a murder. This was not an accident. And at each point, the military tried to cover up, and the military lied, and lied to the family, and lied to, you know, the authorities. And it's just been a shameful episode. And this is about Tillman, who basically, I mean, in the news, the football star that gave up his career and,
yeah,
and left his just married wife, you know, to go in and fight the, you know, the good fight over in Iraq, you know, and believed the hype in the beginning about the weapons of mass destruction, and you know, but he was their poster boy, and you know, the soldier's soldier. And then, you know, when he's killed, all they do is lie about it and cover it up. And so Tillman's parents are calling for a Senate investigation. That's the new leadership, the wonderful leadership that we want to rely on, you know, under John Jones. And John Jones was the head. He's now, you know, making the decisions for in National Security Council for Obama. When he was the head of military officer for the Afghan operation, he refused to interfere with the opium production there because he said it might hurt the economy. Well, the opium production before we went into Afghanistan was 85% of the world opium coming out of there. Now it's 95% of the world opium comes out of Afghanistan, so it's improved. And, you know, and we've been protecting it. And we really just have no business there. We had no business there from the beginning, whether bin Laden was there or not. This was not an act of war by Afghanistan on us. We should have created an international tribunal. There's provisions to do that. The United Nations would have backed it. The Taliban offered three times to turn bin Laden over to such a tribunal for charges if, in fact, he was guilty. And the United States said, we don't negotiate with terrorists, because they weren't responding to 9/11. They were going ahead with a war in Afghanistan that they had planned months in advance, and that Colin Powell had announced to the surrounding countries to take the Taliban out, because they were refusing a cheap price that we wanted to give them to take a pipeline from the Caspian Basin down into the ocean. So we could control the oil coming out of that whole area. And when they balked at the price, the head of the company, Enron and Unocal, were the two companies working on it at different points, but the head of Unocal went and testified to Congress and said that, you know, these people are in our way, they're stopping our progress with the oil, and they have to be eliminated.
Right, okay. That's
some things that are going on in Afghanistan and have been for some time, but it's all illegal. It's all against international law, and we just have no business there.
Yeah, and that's a whole hell of a lot more that you're going to hear from General Electric. I mean, MSNBC. I mean, NBC. That's right.
Yeah.
Or, you know, that they get this label of being, you know, some kind of liberal media outlet, which is laughable to me. It's just people just don't have a much of a
point.
And
this idea that they're going to go in there and get out is just as wrong-headed as going in and getting out of Iraq. It's just going to get worse. All these civilian deaths are creating whole new sets of enemies for them, and they don't seem to care. I mean, you know, they say, well, it's a tragedy, but they know that it's inherent in the nature of the kind of warfare they're carrying on, the kind of weapons they're using, and they don't care.
Exactly.
You know, it's collateral damage to them, and so be it. You know.
Exactly. Yeah, it's a means to an end. It's a means to an end. In that vein, I actually want to play a clip from Black Agenda Report. I got some news clips from Black Agenda Report and Glenn Ford, and you know, it may seem kind of off the beaten path, but it's really not. You know, because we're talking about Katrina, and John has a wealth of expertise on the role that private security forces, you know, played in Iraq and are playing in Iraq. And I know that Blackwater just pulled out, but they were there for a while. DynCorp was there.
Pretty much got pushed out.
Exactly, got pushed out, finally.
Mm-hmm.
But they were also in New Orleans post-Katrina, during Katrina, and responsible for taking some lives there. I want to play this clip that I think a lot of folks don't understand about the Obama policy in reference to the Hurricane Katrina, as well specifically looking at the evictions that are still going on with the Katrina diaspora. So if you can listen to this one 1 second, and then at the end of the 2 minutes, John and I will join the other side, and we'll have a conversation about this. And for those of you guys that want to call in and engage yourself with John and myself, join if you have a question or comment, the call-in number is 347-945-5191. That's 347-945-5191, and we'll see you on the other side.
If the response to the crimes of Katrina is the litmus test for 21st century black politics, and it should be, then the Obama administration has failed to distinguish itself from its predecessor under George W. Bush. The Bush imperative was to take gruesome advantage of the hurricane's destruction to accomplish a national goal, to drive poor blacks from the central cities. Every governmental crime of omission and commission in the wake of Katrina was coldly calculated to permanently exile several hundred thousand African Americans from New Orleans. The city was deliberately rendered unlivable for a huge portion of its previous residents, while corporate vultures from across the nation and even Australia schemed to create a new urban model minus African Americans. From the beginning, candidate Obama denied that racism played a role in Katrina's aftermath. The prevailing incompetence, he said, was colorblind, proving either that he, Obama, was the blind one, or that the man who would be president is as hostile to the inner city poor as George Bush. Obama waited until his first 100 days in office had passed to delegate to his minions the task of evicting Katrina survivors from 3,000 FEMA trailers. Most of the trailer inhabitants are elderly. Two-thirds of them own homes that they have been trying to make habitable, with or without help from the government. Their evictions from the trailers will make it that much harder to renew their lives as permanent residents of New Orleans, which is the whole point of the evictions. FEMA claims that it has always offered to allow people to buy the trailers for as little as $300, but the trailer residents overwhelmingly dispute that story. According to the New York Times, virtually all of the residents interviewed said they had offered to buy their trailers, but were told they could not. Who are you going to believe, the people or FEMA? And who is to blame? Not George Bush, not anymore. President Obama has effectively adopted the Bush policy on New Orleans in whole. Not a single one of 500 planned Katrina cottages has been made ready for occupancy. Elderly people squat in abandoned buildings. There are no credible plans to repair or create an infrastructure that could accommodate the poor who still remain, much less the New Orleans diaspora scattered to the four winds 3.5 years ago. President Obama's economic stimulus plan, of which he is so proud, revealed his administration's general attitude regarding Katrina. Rather than putting people to work rebuilding New Orleans for the benefit of its original population, the administration and Congress allocated the city less money than any other congressional district. And it was under Obama that the latest federal actions to demolish public housing in the city have occurred. The line between Bush and Obama has not simply blurred in New Orleans, it has disappeared. The ominous ramifications reverberate far beyond the Gulf Coast. If post-Katrina New Orleans is the urban model for the future, then black America has a great deal to fear from the Obama White House. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to www.blackagendareport.com.
And John, and before you comment, John, I just want to say something. It's amazing to me how many people, you know, number one, thought that just because the advent of a black president, that automatically meant that we had transitioned ourselves into a post-racial society. And I think that that's part of, like, the grand scheme. That's part of the grand scheme of the powers that be, is that, you know, you place this different face, this remarkably different face on a power structure, that is virtually, you know what I'm saying, stayed the same in terms of its operation of lack of distribution of resources, lack of distribution of wealth, and the lack of distribution of just overall representative power of the people. And you put that there, and all of a sudden people are in this kind of like this zombification, thinking that everything is all good, but yet we still see that there's police brutality that's going on, and evidenced by Adolph Grimes, evidenced by Oscar Grant. And we see the fact that, you know, even, you know, when Senator Obama was running for president, you know, when asked about, you know, what happened to Sean Bell, you know, the young brother who was murdered by the New York Police Department, you know, on the eve of his wedding day, you know, Obama, you know, in essence, you know, said that, you know, this is, we're a land of just laws. We need to respect the verdict of the judge, you know, and he shied away from anything. And so it's always the first thing I always hear, like a lot of folks are saying, well, he's not the president of Black America. Okay, you're right. He's not the president of Black America. You're right. He is the president of all America. But in the way that he's acting and what he's saying and his policies, it, you know what I'm saying, it's clear that, I guess, in his world, Black America is not part of America, because he's not, you know what I'm saying, he's not touching on your issues. And so if you could, you know, comment on what we just heard about the Katrina evictions. I know that you've probably read something about that and definitely have some takes and comments on that.
Well, Katrina happened while Cynthia McKinney was in office, and when I was working for her, and we on the staff developed a very extensive 75-page report that's still up online, that was a supplemental to the Katrina Commission in Congress, raising many of the issues that still haven't been resolved about the environmental impact, the impact on the poor. We helped to try to form a Katrina caucus on both sides, Senate and House, and to combine and track various legislation to get good bills passed that would actually help people there. And I remember Cynthia had a very strong reaction to one of the Louisiana congressmen, not remembering his name now, but he his initial comment that week was, God just solved the low-income housing problem. Mm-hmm. And you know, the racism of the response of FEMA was palpable, and their responses in other white communities to these kind of disasters don't show that kind of so-called incompetence. Part of the delay was not incompetence. It was that George Bush was insisting on exercising basically martial law in the situation, and wanted authority to take over the entire state guard. Normally, the state guard works under the governor and works easily in conjunction with FEMA and the military and the Pentagon, but there's never been any problem with doing that. But Bush wanted total control of the guard, and Blanco, the governor, Kathleen Blanco, said no. You know, she balked at it, and so for 3 days the feds refused to send any help at all. And, you know, that was not incompetence. That was a political decision. You know, and then they blocked help that was being offered. You know, there were trucks and trains and boats that wanted to come in and help and bring supplies, and FEMA was blocking the roads and blocking their access in to get to people. Nearby military bases that could have been activated, you know, to help out were just sitting, and nobody giving them orders. And it was very clear that they didn't care whether these Black poor in the Ninth Ward and the predominant areas that were affected survived, and that they'd rather they didn't survive, or at least that they moved them out. And then they gathered them first into this dome where they had no proper you know, heating or light or bathroom conditions. Kept them in there for days, strip searched them on the way in, and then took them out and put them into buses, sometimes splitting families up, not telling them where they were going.
Right.
It's sending them around the country into different situations. And, you know, and they kept referring to them, as you remember, as refugees.
Yeah, refugees, yeah.
Yeah, not survivors of a catastrophe, but refugees. Well, refugees don't have any rights.
Right.
You know, and so they were being treated as people who weren't citizens and didn't have rights. And, you know, just manipulated, and then it became clear that they didn't want them ever to move back.
Yeah.
And that's been the policy since. And, you know, I don't, it is putting, you know, one of the memos that I gave Cynthia years back, even before I worked for her, that I got out under Freedom of Information Act through the JFK Act and other things on the King and the COINTELPRO, was a document where they clearly said that they wanted to eliminate Dr. King and replace him with a clean Negro.
Yeah,
and if you remember, Joe Biden called Obama clean,
yeah.
You know, and got into some trouble for it during the primary. And so he, you know, he was, I think, basically like a black face that was, first of all, thrown into the engine of a train wreck that the Republicans created as they went out of office. And then secondly, you know, basically put the face up there to preside over an emerging international and global fascism. And, you know, it's we've had black faces on these positions before. We've had black heads of the State Department and heads of the Joint Chiefs, and, you know,
right.
It hasn't changed the policies.
No.
You know, and we shouldn't expect that this is going to change policies. That in fact, if but this disingenuous thing that he's not the president of Black America, therefore he can't act in the interests of any black people, that's almost worse than the racism.
Yeah, it is.
I mean, you know, you can't imagine a white president saying, "I'm not the president of Black America,"
exactly.
And saying, "I'm going to ignore black people,
yeah,
and their problems." So, but it's somehow, you know, verboten for him to, as a black man, respond to black issues. Well, what
yeah.
nonsense? What, you know, totally reverse? I mean, then you say there's no racism. I mean, that's like racism in prime. You know,
exactly.
That he's not allowed to show any favoritism. You know, so therefore black people have to suffer for him to make sure that he doesn't upset any of the white people. And as I said during the primary, you know, period, that the whites are not afraid that he's a terrorist. They're afraid that he's a black person.
Yeah.
You know, and
right.
And the Reverend Wright response and everything else has just borne that out to me. You know, and you know, certainly no. I mean, you don't want somebody acting as blatantly as white people in that position acted in favoritism to the whites all those years, and to just reverse such a policy, but to use that balance point as a reason not to respond to something as horrific as these trailers and displacement of people, you know, and doing nothing to change the policies around it or trying to come up, because they don't need FEMA trailers, they need somebody to go in and redevelop their community and, you know, help them out with doing that and put them back where they lived.
And what you see right now is the disaster of capitalism that kicked into full gear that Naomi Klein in her book Shock Doctrine eloquently, you know, put into a beautiful context. And, you know, how there are folks like, you know, Milton Friedman and disciples of his, you know, who said that this is, you know, this was, you know, it was an opportunity, you know, it was an
mm-hmm.
opportunity to, and you see what went on with the school systems, where the vast majority of the school the schools within the New Orleans public school system are now under private control. They're, you know, they're charter schools that, yeah, they're publicly funded, but they're privately run, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And so that means that somebody, you know, that money is going to somebody's coffers. And you know, many of those kids that were there initially at some of those schools don't have the opportunity to come back to those schools for a few reasons, you know, displacement and also because, you know, that they're not the type of material that those schools administrators are willing to welcome back, you know.
Yeah.
And so looking at you know, segueing to education, this also came out this week in terms of in reference to the increase that the kind of the smokescreen in terms of the increase that the Obama administration was putting into the Pell Grant. But however, what wasn't mentioned on, I didn't see it in any mainstream media outlet, the fact that HBCUs, historically black colleges and universities, are now taking a major, major funding hit. And, you know, Glenn Ford talks about it right here, and we will on the other side.
Barack Obama encourages people to believe that he deserves to be remembered as the education president. However, Obama will definitely not go down as a friend of historically black higher education. Historically black colleges and universities, HBCUs, take a $73 million hit in Obama's educational budget. The cuts are even more disturbing since education, as a general category, is a big winner in the president's economic stimulus plan. Obama's people claim that an increase in maximum Pell Grant monies for low-income students will help all educational institutions, including historically black ones. But that's not quite true. Even if every one of the 132,000 Pell Grant students that attend HBCUs collected the maximum $200 extra in Obama's budget, that would only make up for one-third of the administration's cuts to black schools. In other words, Obama's slightly rising tide of Pell Grants will not sufficiently lift historically black higher education votes. The $73 million loss would have an outsized impact on the 105 black institutions, many of which are perennially on shaky financial ground, and all of which have been hit hard by the current economic crisis. Although black schools make up only 3% of total U.S. college enrollment, they account for one out of every five undergraduate degrees awarded to African Americans. It would be difficult to find any place in the federal budget where $73 million has a more concentrated impact on the fortunes of a particular ethnic group. A direct comparison might be made with colleges that traditionally serve large numbers of Hispanic students. However, the Obama budget actually increased direct federal aid to these schools from $93 million to $98 million. Native American higher education, on the other hand, gets the black treatment, a decrease in federal funding to Indian schools. The Obama administration's callous disregard for black colleges is even more curious, considering the president's constant quest for areas of bipartisan consensus. Support for black higher education is one of the rare issues around which Southern white Republicans and members of the Congressional Black Caucus often find common ground. North Carolina is home to 11 HBCUs. The state's Republican Senator, Richard Burr, wonders how Obama managed to find $9 million to fund a museum on the history of the whaling industry, but makes devastating cuts in black higher education. The timing couldn't be worse. Many black colleges were the products of philanthropy and depend on it still. But philanthropy is way down, which has pushed many black institutions even closer to the edge. President Obama should also be given a brief refresher course in the history that makes direct aid to black schools necessary. Blacks were deliberately shut out of most higher education for almost the entirety of United States history. For that reason, black institutions operate under specific disadvantages while shouldering oversized responsibilities. There is nothing race-neutral about it. Past and present racial realities require that Obama give up the money. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to www.blackagendareport.com.
John, as you comment on this, could you mix in? I really want you to, if you could talk about the work that you do with your nonprofit organization called Choices. What does Choices stand for? What's the work that you do? Because I think that when we're talking about HBCUs, and you know they're talking about one in five African Americans, you know, that receives a college education, it comes by way of HBCU. I think it's definitely like relevant to talk about. The crisis on the secondary educational level, specifically looking at the fact that, you know, black males in this country, you know, are graduating at a 47 to 48% clip from high schools. And we look at the militarization, the growing militarization of predominantly black and brown schools. And it's interesting that our Secretary of Education appointed by Barack Obama, Arne Duncan, you know, used to be the CEO, interesting name for a superintendent, but the CEO of the Chicago public school system. And, you know, during his tenure there, he just went ahead and converted, I think it was like something like seven schools that were predominantly black and brown into military schools. He basically sold those schools' rights and, you know, and control to the military. What's the work that you do with Choices? How is it relative to the military? If you could speak about it, and then if you could give some contact information as well, if anyone's listening that might want to build with you in the future, whether it's in their city. I know we have some folks on the West Coast, Oakland and Seattle, that are listening right now, and how the, you know, so basically how they can get in contact with you.
Well, Choices is Committee for High School Options and Information on Careers, Education, and Self-Improvement. And it's a volunteer community group, mostly veterans and military family members, that does what we call counter-recruitment here in the D.C. schools. We have a rule here that's from the school board in 1980, at which point they got rid of mandatory ROTC, junior ROTC in the schools for 4 years, a military program that they ran there, Reserve Officer Training Corps, although it wasn't training anybody to be an officer. Part of that decision was to leave the JROTC programs in the schools in exchange for letting people come in to counter the recruiters and counter the program, which is a recruiting program itself. And so we've been relying on that rule since 85 to bring veterans into the schools and talk to young people about realities of combat and military life, and also to give them a statistical overview of the special problems that women and people of color face who go into the military, and the very high levels of racism and sexism in the military, and extra problems that they'll face. But then also about the current situation and just how many people are 85% being sent to combat when you join right now, stop loss, which allows them to extend your already 8-year enlistment to 9.5 years, and very high levels of stress that people are going through, third and fourth rotation. I mean, one of the things also that happened in Afghanistan this last week is that this was actually in Iraq, but in the area, was that a sergeant who had been in 15 years and was on third rotation in the country had his weapons taken from him and was put through some kind of an ordeal that left him saying it was the worst 2 days of his life at a counseling center for post-traumatic stress disorder on the field in Iraq. And he ended up coming back to the center after having stolen a gun from an escort and shooting five people, shooting two of the psychiatrists and the psychiatric social worker there, psychologist, and the psychologist he shot had actually written the standard manual that they're using to train everybody right now. And one of the things I saw in the manual was that it tells them not to, that it's bad psychotherapy to allow the veterans to talk to each other. That it's just going to, which was the only way that veterans after Vietnam survived, was it going to vet-to-vet counseling centers and drop-in centers that were run by vets, where they could talk to peers about what they'd been through. And this, of course, wants to force them to talk only to the psychiatrists and only to take their drugs, and that's going to be the cure. And it's going to be seen as an illness that the veteran is having, not an outcome of the kind of war that they're fighting and what they're being asked to do. So, that happened this week, and there's more to it. And, the guy's father's saying that he was pushed to it, something they said to him, and who knows what, whether they were telling him they were going to boot him out or he wasn't going to get his retirement or what, but something flipped him, took him over the edge, and then he shot these people. And, they were calling it or comparing it to fragging, when at first we didn't know the identity of the people he shot or what their rank was. But fragging was a term about fragmentation grenades that were used in the third rotation in Vietnam. People began to kill the young officers who didn't know what they were doing, and the second lieutenants that were taking them into battle zones, without any sense of what they were doing and losing a lot of troops, would get blown up by fragmentation grenades by their own troops or shot, and that was called fragging. And it was a resistance to dangerous orders into the war itself. It wasn't, as they were posing it in the papers this week, situations where, an enlisted member shot other enlisted members, or fellow soldiers, as they were putting it. Fragging was not fellow shoulder shooting, it was officer shooting, and officer killing. And you know, they're, again, they're trying to depoliticize the context and go away from the history. So, you know, it was a very specific thing, and there was some of that in that in this because the psychiatrist was a the doctors are officers, but this was more specific to the mistreatment he got at the clinic and whatever they were putting him through as a test, his wife said, and that he was very, very upset, told her that, you know, he might kill himself or have to kill somebody, and was writing to her about problems he was having. So there's unanswered questions still about what happened, but they all these people are very stressed there. A third of them come home with some kind of stress problems. As of January, the Army active duty suicide rate climbed above their combat death rate. Overall military suicide statistics are above civilian statistics now for the first time. And the veteran statistics, which are only tracked 3 months out, and most people don't even hit their stress point till 6 months out, but even tracking 3 months out, they've got a 600% rise in the last year in veteran suicides. You know, it's putting people in harm's way. Certainly people get killed, they get wounded. They're more likely to survive a wounding now, but that means they live with it for the rest of their life and try to recover from it psychologically and physically. And on top of that, the racism leads to one of three African Americans ending up with less than honorable discharge as they come out. And that's lifelong unemployment discrimination that's legal against them, plus losing all of their benefits. It's one out of eight overall, but one out of three if you're black. Four times as likely to be court-martialed and put into the prison system in the military if you're black. And African-American males leaving now are four times as unemployed and four times as homeless as kids that don't go in. So we try to give them a real picture of what it is they're going into, 68-hour, 80-hour work week, pay against those hours that's less than McDonald's, not learning usable skills, existing under a special law where you don't have constitutional or civil rights or the right to refuse anything you're told to do or to talk back to the boss or walk off the job, or crimes in the military that they'll suffer for. And then on top of that, being sent into homicidal situations and, you know, where they're killing other people and being killed, and also quite often involved in killing innocent civilians and having to live with that. So, you know, it's not much of an option, but they rely on a poverty draft, and they're relying on it now with the bad economy, that black people will see that that's their, see it as their only option. And they also promise that they'll send them to college. But from the beginning of the GI Bill, Montgomery Bill, the black college statistics on enrollment kept going down, and black enlistment kept going up until the start of the Iraq War. And so it was a false promise. They made over $2 billion from people paying in, expecting to get college money when they got out, who weren't able to or didn't use it. And, you know, they touted this thing as, you know, getting you to college. They didn't give you an SAT beforehand to see if you were even eligible for college. They know that a year and a half out, most people will not go back to college anyway. And so very few people, 35% of the eligible people, ever used it at all, and 15% of those ever graduated from college. So as a way to get to college, it's probably the least effective one. And there's $6 billion out in the civilian world. Of course, you know, they're cutting, you know, the scholarships are cutting the, you know, as he was talking about, these colleges are suffering financially, and the students are going to have a harder time. But it's not an impossible time to find money for college, especially if you live in D.C. They have programs just for that, and they have billions of dollars still out in the civilian world that people need to research and apply for. But the military promises a lot of things to people, bonuses, college, training, that don't pan out in the end and don't really help people when they get out, and that's clear from the statistics. You know, it's also very dangerous for women. 75% are constantly sexually harassed, according to the polls, and the reported level of rape is four times as high as in the civilian world.
Wow.
And so we not only tell them that that's maybe not their best option, but we give them better options. We give them information on apprenticeships and trade schools. We give them information on community agencies that will help them, help train them for jobs and get them into the work world. Summer programs, and also where they can go to get counseling on money for college and scholarships and loans in the community and around the country on the web.
That's, so that's, that, That's amazing. How can people get in contact with you if they want more information?
The P.O. Box is 7147 in Washington, D.C., 20044 for choices. People can email me at johnjudge, J-O-H-N-J-U-D-G-E, at starpower.net. And also they should be aware that there's a national network opposed to militarization of youth, and we're one of the founding groups of that. And that network, from July the 17th to the 19th in Chicago, is going to hold a national conference on countering recruitment and also militarism and the militarization of youth in the society and the schools. And we fight those policies here in D.C., but people interested can go to NNOMY, National Network Opposed to Militarization of Youth, NNOMY.org, and get information about the conference and hopefully can attend. But there are people doing this work all around the country. There are a lot of veterans in the Iraq Vets Against the War and Veterans for Peace and Military Families Speak Out members who help with this in countries around the nation. And there just needs to be more of it, more outreach to young people and getting them involved, but also to change the policies that allow the recruiters to come in and get their contact information, that force them into JROTC programs or fund JROTC programs at the cost of desks and teachers and working computers and other things that are more central to the core purpose of the school, and paying, which they have to do, half of the cost of this military recruiting program to limit recruiter access in the schools to the same access that other careers have, not constant and undue access all the time as the most represented alternative or option, and to stop the use of the Armed Services Vocational Aptitude Battery, replacing real skill and aptitude tests for students, since it only measures military-related skills, and it's both race and gender biased, and everybody who goes to the military takes it, and it's a major recruiting tool. They use it, again, to capture the information and then get the results to the parents and try to sell the parents on putting the kid into the military. Delayed entry program. That is the most common way they recruit 95% for a delayed reporting date, and then they threaten the kids that if they don't show up, they'll be arrested. But in fact, even that threat is illegal, and it's not true. And if you just don't show up on the reporting date, you're discharged. But these recruiters don't want them to know that, and I tell the kids that these recruiters have to make a quota every month in order to maintain their job as a recruiter. And so, basically, if they don't get you to go to Iraq or Afghanistan, they're going to have to go.
That's right. And I believe, like, these recruiters are under tremendous duress. I believe in the month of January, there are more deaths from suicide from Army recruiters than there were actual, infantry in combat in Iraq or Afghanistan.
Well, there was a rush of deaths, certainly, at certain bases of the recruiters because of the pressure that they're under. And, and there was a story of one recruiter who got his cousin to join. Cousin went to Iraq and died, and the recruiter killed himself.
Killed himself. And what's the percentage right now? If I had a son right now and he was 18 and I, cajoled him to go into the military, what's the percentage in terms of the likelihood of him getting sent over to Iraq or Afghanistan right now?
If you join right now, 85% are going to the combat zone, men and women both.
Gee, 85%.
Yeah. 85%. And meanwhile, the recruiters are still telling kids, and so I was just today at Coolidge High School, and the kids told me the recruiters tell them that they won't have to go to Iraq and they won't have to go to Afghanistan if they join.
Unbelievable. So that's great information.
The recruiter has nothing to do with whether they go to those places. Even if they put something in writing, because it's a time of war, it's worthless.
Mm-hmm.
And they can change it at any point.
Right.
And so this agreement is not a contract. It's just something that binds you, not them. And they do what they want with you.
Right.
While you're in, and then after you're out. I mean, the veterans are not treated properly. They're experimented on in the VA, and their real needs are not answered, and they don't know how to counsel them for the stress.
Right.
Long delays, and all that's being cut as well. under Bush and not renewed under Obama is aid to veterans.
Yeah. Right.
So, you know, there's a lot of issues around this, but we need to start looking at the military as our own institution and determining how we want it to function and how we want it to treat people and not leave that up to some people in the Pentagon.
Exactly. And the military doesn't have to, we need to like reprogram ourselves away from this thing that the military has to be used as a tool of aggression. I mean, the military can be used right here at home. I mean, what if we had adequately used the military to go into the lower Ninth Ward, go into New Orleans, go into St. Bernard's Parish, go into the Gulf Coast, and to clean up and actually serve as humanitarians and not have the military deployed, you know, for purposes of imperialism and aggression. And it's almost comical that it's called the Department of Defense. It should be called the Department of Aggression.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just, you know, the U.S., you know, spends more money, you know, per year on military than I believe like the next 28 countries combined, you know, and it's
right. Well, a defensive military wouldn't have this kind of a budget. It wouldn't have 2 million people in it. It wouldn't have, you know, bases in 130 countries around the world. That's not defense. I mean, that's intervening in countries all over the place and, you know, being a world presence and, you know, pushing people around with our weight. And, you know, better yet, why even have the military do the civilian things? I mean, let's just train civilians to do those kind of things. And they don't need the military training to go in and do humanitarian work.
Right.
Just reduce the size of the military and take part of the budget and put it into the real programs that people need for health care and, you know, emergencies and everything else. But the society is so militarized that FEMA is basically an extension of the Pentagon. The National Health Service is an extension of the Pentagon. The Center for Disease Control is a Pentagon organization. They are all military. They have military officers. Public Health Service is military. And there's a connection now. And another thing I've been looking into we might want to talk about tonight is all this push for this flu pandemic. But it's a trigger since Bush for going into martial law and having the military take over the society and repealing the Posse Comitatus Act so that they can arrest people and go into continuity of government and change the nature of the government based on the threat of a plague or a disease outbreak and quarantine people and use the plan is all to use the military to do that and to switch over the powers of the president when those things happen.
The flu pandemic, and I would like to talk about that. And before I have you touch on that, and in terms of telling the listeners your research surrounding this so-called flu pandemic, this so-called swine flu.
Mm-hmm.
Note to listeners: if you don't know, listen. All this information that we're discussing is available. But specifically looking at Obama, his projected, like what he requested this upcoming fiscal year for military is more money than, you know, Bush ever requested or ever received. And so if you're, you know, angered about the amount of money that is being spent on military, that's not being spent on healthcare, that's not being spent on, reestablishing a solid school system in terms of infrastructure and programs and programs of social uplift, then you know, it doesn't matter whether you voted for him or not. I mean, it gives you even more reason. If you voted for somebody, him or her, and they're not upholding, you know, the things, the promises that they gave you during the campaign or the things that you were sold on that you thought that was going that you were going to see in terms of change, that's even more reason to hold their feet to the fire. You know what I'm saying? Because if the supporters of candidate X or what have you are not pressuring that candidate, you really think that there's any chance that candidate is actually gonna buckle or try to change or try to make some accommodations? If you look at some of the things passed in the past from affirmative action or what have you, these weren't passed by genuine, you know, candidates or you know, presidents that actually necessarily gave a damn about equal rights. It was because there was a strong groundswell, a critical mass that was pushing for this kind of change. And so it's important for you to you know what I'm saying, do what you can to pressure your elected officials, whether it's Obama or Nancy Pelosi or whoever. So, but what's going on with this swine flu, John? Like, what is this swine flu? Like, what is your research telling you? Is it something that was born out of swine, or is it something that came out of a petri dish? What is it?
Well, it doesn't exist in the pigs, and it wasn't in the pigs on the farms in Mexico where people first got sick in Veracruz. It wasn't among pigs here. They were calling it a swine flu. Then they started calling it a H1N1 human virus. Then they said that they'd never seen anything like it before, that it was a triple reassortment, genetic reassortment of the Asian bird flu and human flu and a swine flu, a European swine flu. So, of course, the general idea is that it's somehow initiated in Mexico. Well, the sickness and the deaths might have initiated from it there, but that doesn't explain what its origin is, and even the World Health Organization, the CDC, still admit they don't know what its origin is or where it came from or how it got started, but it does not come from eating pork, or it's not in pigs. It was just called a swine flu because it had been reassorted, which means that the virus crosses over from one species to another, and then you get a genetic new strain that may be more lethal or it may be more mild. But normally, at the most, that's going to happen between two species transfers, not three. They'd never seen it in three. And that indicated to me from the beginning that this most likely came out of some kind of a lab where they were working on developing something. Now, I've been following for years chemical biological weapon research that they've been doing at Fort Detrick and elsewhere. In fact, there's a lot of personnel crossover between Fort Detrick and the Center for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta. And, the people around many of these situations are people that came directly out of the chemical and biological warfare labs. In addition to that, the CDC and one researcher who sent them the samples back in 2005 were trying to dig up and succeeded in digging up an Inuit woman, a native Alaskan woman, who had died from the swine flu of 1918, which was one of the most lethal flus that ever hit the human community and killed tens of millions, not 40 million, not hundreds of millions, but did kill tens of millions of people.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very lethal, and it went human to human. They dug her up and found intact cell tissue in her lungs in the permafrost from which they could reconstruct. The virus was still intact in their lungs, and so they took the virus, they did a DNA reconstruction, recombinant DNA on it, and then recreated it. Recreated one of the worst viruses that humans had ever seen that had disappeared from the earth. They brought it back to life and at the CDC. And then they said that it was 1,000 times more lethal than they had expected, and they said that it was identical to the Asian bird flu, which was ridiculous because it was a swine flu. It was called Spanish flu, but it was definitely called a swine flu and not a bird flu at that time. And then they said that they wanted to study the trigger that distinguished it from the Asian bird flu, which allows human-to-human passage, because all this time they've been saying that the avian and Asian bird flu could morph into a virus that would cause a pandemic that would kill hundreds of millions of people like the 1918 swine flu did. And they've been pumping that message since 2005. That was the basis on which Bush wrote these orders, setting up a link between a pandemic or even the threat of a pandemic and continuity of government and martial law, and putting out massive plans, which Senator Obama at the time was involved with the planning around what they'd do in terms of a flu pandemic, and went along with these kind of plans to militarize the situation. And he's been making statements through his administration praising the plans that Bush put in effect and saying that they were helping them to respond to this new outbreak. Another thing that I've looked at over the years is is ethnically oriented chemical biological weapons, which they have experimented on for many years to see if they could kill one race and not another. And there's a quote from PNAC, the Project on New American Century, had a report years back about how to increase the defense budget, and they talked about needing a new Pearl Harbor to get what they wanted.
Wow.
But there's a quote in there that specifically addresses developing ethnically oriented chemical and biological weapons, and that that would serve a political purpose. And it's just a chilling quote from these people that were the neocons that went into the Bush administration, were part of that project on New American Century. Cheney was among them, and others of these neocons that served in the, you know, in the White House. So they saw a, a political purpose for, for what they were, what that would mean. You know, that it would be, I don't know if I can find the quote for you, but anyway, they looked at lactose to see if they could gasify lactose, because many African Americans are and Africans in general are lactose intolerant. I believe that AIDS is a lab-created retrovirus that was specific to blood protein differences in blacks and whites that were studied in the 50s as part of this experimentation. And then the same scientist who did that for them in England wrote an article in Lancet where he compared black and white response to the HIV virus and and to AIDS, and said that blacks are much more likely to get the virus, much more likely to have full-blown symptoms sooner, and much more likely to die from it. And if you look at the statistics worldwide on AIDS, it's very clearly a black disease, and it's not. It's not really a gay disease or the way people say it. I mean, because it's spreading throughout Africa. It's the rising cause of AIDS, the cause of death in black communities. And black women, I think it has the highest rate of increase in young black men. And, those are the communities that it's hitting, and that worldwide it's by far a majority black disease. So one of the things that was interesting to me about this, and that I'm still looking at, is why have only the only people that died from this new flu so far, that clearly the flu killed them, have been Mexican and Hispanic people. And when the flu spread up here, it wasn't killing people. Now they're saying there's three deaths, but the other two deaths here, which were not obviously Hispanic people, although they didn't give their whole ethnic histories, they didn't have Hispanic names. One was a guy that died just recently that had massive heart problems and other medical complications. And after he died, they found the flu virus in his system, but they said that they couldn't link. They said it might have been a contributing factor, but they couldn't list it as a cause of death.
Mm-hmm.
And the other woman was pregnant and went into a coma. And then after she died of other medical complications, they said that, you know, she had this flu in her. But in both cases, it's not clear that that's the cause. And so the situation is in the air. But I still think so far it's only been killing Hispanic people, and it may be ethnically oriented. Now, 2 months before all this, at Baxter Company, this huge pharmaceutical, multi-billion-dollar pharmaceutical company, had what they called an accident, which is not something that happens in a normal lab, that you have an accident like this. And they sent out to six countries some human influenza virus to be tested and to work toward a vaccine. And then they said by accident they found out, because it was given to some ferrets, and the ferrets died. And when they did the autopsy work on the ferrets, they showed that it had live H5N1 Asian bird flu mixed in with the human swine flu, or human the human influenza. And so then they destroyed the ferrets, and it's my suspicion that that in fact that was part of creating this new virus in a lab, and that's the way you get biological weapons, is that you do cause new reassortments by taking them through different kinds of organisms. So if you mix the human and bird, and then you put it through a pig, and that adds the pig virus, then this could be this. And while for me it's merely my logical speculation from events, just within the last 2 days, a story broke, only in Bloomberg so far, but Bloomberg is also the only one that covered this Baxter accident. This is Adrian Gibbs, 75 years old, an Australian researcher, who led the development of Hoffman-Roche's Tamiflu drug, and we'll talk about that in a minute, and also the Relenza drug, said in an interview that he intends to publish a report, and this is going to be in a major medical journal that was out today, I haven't seen it yet, suggesting the new strain may have accidentally evolved in eggs scientists use to grow viruses and drug makers use to make vaccines. And Gibbs said he came to his conclusion as part of an effort to trace the virus's origins by analyzing its genetic blueprint. Immediately, the World Health Organization and the CDC are trying to discredit him and say that he's got it all wrong, but he's a leading virologist. He has, probably 20 different key papers out in peer-reviewed medical journals. He says the sooner we get to grips with where it's come from, the safer things might become. He said it could be a mistake that occurred in a vaccine production facility, or the virus could have jumped from a pig to another mammal or a bird before reaching humans. They analyzed publicly available sequences of hundreds of amino acids coded by each of the flu virus's 8 genes. So it's got 8 genes in it. He said he admits to he aims to submit a 3-page paper today for publication in a medical journal. You really want a very sober assessment of science behind the claim, said the WHO guy. So they're trying to say that that it's not the case. The CDC spokesperson Cox said, but contrary to what the author has found, when we do the comparisons that are most relevant, there's no evidence that the virus was derived by passage in eggs. Well, the reason that you put viruses into eggs is to create vaccines. But you don't create a vaccine until you've seen the virus. In other words, people get sick with the virus, you isolate the virus, then you put it in the egg to get the vaccine. Exactly. So the only way that this could have accidentally been in an egg was that they had already developed it in a lab and they were creating the vaccine for it before it was released from the lab.
Okay.
And it's important for people to know that. Now, this Tamiflu that was
Donald
touted all the way back is Hoffman LaRoche, and the chair of Gilead Labs, where it was Donald Rumsfeld. And Rumsfeld made tremendous profits on it by selling it during the scare in 2005 about the Asian bird flu becoming widespread. So on this false claim, because it has no human-to-human trigger, it's never been anything but bird to bird, and a very few cases of bird to human when the people worked around the birds all the time. It wasn't really a threat, but he came into the Defense Department and decisions were made in the Bush administration and by him to stockpile this drug and 1.5 billion doses, $1.5 billion doses just in the U.S. alone, and more billions worldwide put this drug out. Now, this drug doesn't do anything, and that's as late as March. The Journal of American Medical Association says that Tamiflu is no use against human swine virus, and the H1N1 drug is resistant to Tamiflu, so it won't do anything to that. They had done these studies where they claimed that it would help with with Asian bird flu. But those studies show that only if you use it in the first 40 hours after the person gets the flu, most people think they're still having a cold in the first 40 hours and they don't get it, go in to get it checked, and after 40 hours it doesn't work at all.
Right.
If you get it in the first 40 hours, 14% of the people who get it have one day of the flu symptoms reduced. And, I mean, if I got a 14 on a test, I think I'm flunking it.
Yeah.
And yet this was called the best, the most effective drug and bought in these huge doses. And when they first put it out, they didn't indicate that it should be given to children. And they hadn't tested it on children, you know, age 1 to 12. And they said it shouldn't be given to infants at all. There'd been no tests. And it had counterindications when they were testing it on the Vietnamese young people, which is where this current flu is going, is to young people between 12 and 54. It's not hitting the very old, and it's not hitting the very young, like most earlier flus did. And that was part of what marked the 1918 bird flu as well. And so, you know, they had counterindicated it for that, and then it just wasn't that effective. But when they tested it on these Vietnamese teenagers, they found that it's hallucinogenic, and it causes severe hallucinations, and these kids went and jumped off a roof and died after they took Tamiflu. And now there's been more longer-term studies that show positively that this just wasn't a random thing, that that Tamiflu has that and many other dangerous side effects to your health in general.
When toxic in babies.
Health and Human Services made this into a public health emergency and several states declared emergencies, one of the things that did was take all of the normal limits off of the use of the drugs that are being used during the pandemic, so that if the drug is counterindicated for children, it's lifted, and it's going to be given intentionally to children and to tiny infants. And that, and the CDC is even being, and the WHO have been recommending that it be given to these infants, even though there's never been tested. And special laws kick in that make the drug company immune if anything happens to you from the drugs you're given during a pandemic. And so this is, in my view, a very dangerous and useless drug, but in their early studies, they said it lasted 12 months. When the 12 months came close to ending, suddenly their papers changed, and they said it lasts 36 months, with no citation of a study or anything to show how they had suddenly extended it. But they said it was good for 36 months. Well, this is stuff that was bought in 05, so now the 36 months is ending as we come into this current period, and we have this tremendous public relations flap, and now we're finding out that they estimate, because not everybody who gets the flu reports it, They take any figure they have of morbidity or mortality, and they multiply it by 15. And so, you know, we were told at first that there were thousands of cases and hundreds of deaths, and now we're down to like 26 deaths, you know. And, you know, but like this figure that they use, that 36,000 people die of regular seasonal influenza, is a 15% projection. 15 times the normal figure, and it's a compilation of both pneumonia deaths and flu deaths. They lumped them together, and so this created a panic, and they went to now they're at a level 5 pandemic, even though the stuff is backing off and people aren't getting as sick of it here, and the deaths have stopped in Mexico, apparently, at least for the time being, but using that, they then got the Obama administration to put another $1.5 billion toward preparation, including buying whole new slews of this Tamiflu, and Relenza, which also doesn't work against it, has the 40-hour limit and limited capability. Now, there is a natural product called Sambucol, S-A-M-B-U-C-O-L. You can get it at health food stores and hopefully at CVS. It's cheap. It's under $2 a bottle. Tastes good. It's an extract of elderberry wine, and it will kill 90% of people that take it at any point during the flu. It's effective. It will kill 99% of the viruses in humans or any other animal, It'll knock 3 to 4 days off of the flu symptoms. And it's a natural product, you know, and even if you're having a seasonal flu, it's very effective. It doesn't have any resistance to it that comes from some of these engineered drugs. And it just got an NIH study done long-term with placebos that show that it's a very effective antigen to the flu. But instead of buying this, you know, which would have been cheap and effective, we're stuck with millions of doses of this Tamiflu, which is counterindicated. But what the origins of this flu is and where it came from, and that you have this top scientist saying that he believes the genes show that it came out of a laboratory, I think is very significant. This is
very suspicious at the very least.
This guy spent most of his academic career studying plant viruses. It says the major contribution to the study of influenza occurred in 75, while he collaborated with scientists Graham Laver and Robert Webster in research that led to the development of the anti-flu medicines Tamiflu and Relenza. So this is their own person, for GlaxoSmithKline, for Relenza. You know, he developed it, and now he's coming out and saying this stuff is coming out of a lab. And that's what I was saying at the beginning, because it was just too strange. They'd never seen it before. And this idea that it would just normally get three different, you know, organisms involved in it, and then a European swine gene, not a Mexican swine, you know. And also it can be blamed and is being blamed on, you know, any immigrants.
Immigration.
And so it can become an excuse to lock the whole border down and even to deport people. And FEMA has something called Operation Endgame to round up all of the immigrants and send them back south. And they have huge facilities they're building that will hold the thousands of people in the beds before they, you know, deport them. And then if the military comes in, the military will implement this along with FEMA. And FEMA and Department of Homeland Security and the Pentagon are all the agencies that are cooperating, CDC, and responding to this. And it's responded to not, you know, in an open way and through community health centers. It's responded to by changing the nature of the presidency. And even in Mexico, they were giving the president expanded powers and following the same kind of a pattern as they have planned here.
That's right. Well, John, we have 1 minute left, and this will not be the last time that John Judge is on the show. I'm going to try to keep him on a regular rotation, perhaps like once a month. And mm-hmm. So I'm getting the message from my producer that we have 90 seconds left.
Okay.
I just want to give John's email again. It's John Judge, JohnJudge, @starpower.net. That's his email address. If you're interested in anything that he was discussing, prospectively bringing him in as a public speaker, I can attest he's an outstanding public speaker for any event that you might have for your organization, or if you want to build with him based on the work he's doing with his alternative museum, as well as even more importantly with the stuff that he's doing with Choices, please email him. We'll see you next week. Thank you for tuning in. And this is why we need alternative media, because this is the kind of news that you won't get in the mainstream media, and you certainly won't get in this context. So I'm Solomon Kamajan for Your World News. On behalf of John Judge, we'll see you next week.
Yeah. Third world, motherfucker. I'm from where the golden diamonds are ripped from the earth, right next to the slave castles where the water is cursed, from where police brutality's not half as nice. It makes the hood in America look like paradise, compared to the AIDS infested Caribbean slum. African streets with a passport and American gun, from where they massacre people and try to keep it quiet, and spend the next 25 years trying to deny it. I'm from where they cut your hands off if you make a fist. A nigga stole coca cause the job market doesn't exist. Except slave labor, modern day company store, and peacekeepers don't ever, ever, ever come. come here no more. From where the bombs that they used to drop on Vietnam, still are children born deformed 8 months before they gone. I'm from where they lost the true meaning of the Quran, cause heroin is not compatible with Islam.